Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest on Keeping the Faith today is Mark Braverman, who's the author of Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. We're talking with Mark by phone. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you.
Great. And where exactly are you in this world?
I'm in Bethesda, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C., Steve.
Near D.C. But you're going to be coming to Champaign-Urbana here at the University of Illinois in 12 days on Friday, February 10 and Saturday the 11th to give a series of talks. And I might just mention you're also going to be on the radio here on WILL on Focus with David Inge, another live call-in program where you're going to be specifically talking about your book, Fatal Embrace. But today we're going to be talking about some of the religious issues that you bring up in that book, and I really appreciate you being willing to do this not only once, but twice.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve. Good to be here.
And I might just give a quick outline of where you're speaking when. I realize this program, of course, is heard all over eastern Indiana and northern Illinois as well, but for people who are close enough to come or who might like to make a little journey, you start early on Friday, February 10, at 8:30 in the morning, a discussion breakfast at the University YMCA on campus, 1001 South Wright Street. That's the role of the faith communities in achieving a just peace in the Holy Land, and that's hosted by the Religious Workers Association here at the university. And then the live interview with David Inge on Focus at 10 a.m. that morning. And, of course, that's right here on WILL AM 580. And then you're giving a public lecture sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the university at 11:30 in the Foreign Language Building in the Lucy Ellis Lounge. That's a public lecture at 11:30 on Friday, February 10. And then at 1 o'clock, another lecture, but to a class, so that's not really open to the public. But then again, there'll be a student discussion after that at 3 at the United Church of Christ, sponsored by the Campus Ministry on 6th Street, 6th and Daniel. But another public lecture at 7 p.m. that night at the Champaign Public Library, and your title is The Path to Peace in Israel-Palestine, A Jewish American's Journey. And then finally, Saturday morning at St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Urbana on Philo Road at 9:30 in the morning, a public discussion taking the next step or our role in bringing peace to the Holy Land. So you're going to be very busy those 2 days.
Yes, I am.
I hope you can rest up between now and then. Again, that's February 10, Friday, and February 11, Saturday. And all this is sponsored by the Urbana-Champaign Peace Initiative. And if you'd like more information about any of this, you can go to their website or email them for more information. But Mark, let's jump right into our conversation here today about some of the religious issues that you raise in this book. And let's start by just telling listeners about your fascinating personal history with Israel and Palestine, your family.
Well, yeah, it does go back to my family. My grandfather is an unusual history for a Jewish American, a second-generation American. My grandfather was actually born in Palestine, probably around the year 1900 in the old city of Jerusalem, and he was fifth generation in Palestine. There had been Jewish...
You said fifth generation.
Fifth generation. The family came over from somewhere in Central Europe in the mid-19th century. They were very, very pious, and their reason for being there was to study and to do charity, and they were probably somewhat supported by Jewish communities in Europe at the time. And so they settled just, you know, in the shadow of the site of Solomon's Temple. My grandfather was one of six children. He was the only one who left, married my grandmother, which was sort of his ticket to the United States.
And you said that was an arranged marriage.
It was an arranged marriage. My great-grandfather my grandmother's father had three daughters, and he was going to marry them off, and he was very, very pious, and he was going to marry them off to Jews of a suitable pedigree. And my grandfather fit the bill. I mean, this is a family that is a direct descendant of one of the great rabbis of Europe. Sometimes I say to people, if you want to know about Jewish blue blood, you know, you're looking at it. This is connections way back to the heart of European Jewry and the rabbinic tradition. So Zionism, you could say that the connection to the sort of the Zionist dream and the Zionist romance, the idea of Jewish settlement in Palestine and Jewish connection to Jerusalem, is really in my blood. We were always raised with the sense that that's where we came from and that we felt connected to the place.
And, of course, this was long, many decades before the State of Israel.
Yes, and so I say, you know, my grandfather was not a Zionist in the modern sense of the term. But to him, he lived in Palestine, which was Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, and he connected it with the Bible, not with a modern political entity. Now, having said that, I was born in 1948 in Philadelphia, which is a fairly strong Jewish community, into a fairly traditional family. And, you know, if you're a Jewish kid born in the United States into a strongly identified Jewish family, after World War II, after the Nazi genocide, and after, well, really within months of the establishment of the State of Israel, you're not just raised in traditional Judaism. You're raised in Zionism, and that really became part of the religion, part of Jewish identity, connection with the state of Israel, not some spiritual or biblical concept, but a modern political entity. And we said prayers to the state of Israel in the synagogue. That became part of modern Jewish life.
Now, what branch of Judaism were you raised in?
I was raised in the conservative movement.
Conservative,
sort of. It's the midpoint between Orthodox Judaism, which is what you would imagine it is, very traditional, and Reform.
Actually, our listeners who were paying attention last week to this program heard the director of the Hillel Foundation here locally. Rabbi Kukkorn talking about the various denominations.
Okay, so they know what we're talking about. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we hope so. But go ahead. You were saying that was where you were raised.
I was raised in that. I think the only point I was going to make, Steve, was that this melding of political Zionism and traditional Judaism is a fairly modern phenomenon. It's only in the past, 60 years or so. Before that, much or most of organized Judaism was officially either non-Zionist or anti-Zionist. The sense was, we want to be a faith community like Lutherans or Presbyterians or Roman Catholics, although, of course, there's the connection to the Vatican. But we want to be a faith community. We don't think that the idea of being connected with a nationalist state is a good idea. But then after World War II, after the incredible trauma of what happened to the Jews in Europe, and after the actual establishment of the state itself, there's kind of a train that you had to be on. And now if you express any reservations about what has happened with the State of Israel and any reservations about the idea that the Jewish people need to have a national ethnic homeland, it's sort of like you've gone off the reservation and you become marginalized, and you can actually be subject to a fair amount of being called names.
Let's talk a little bit about who your book is addressed to. In the title, the subtitle, Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, did you have, as you were writing this, as you were pulling all this together, as you were reading in Christian sources as well as Jewish sources, were you thinking of trying to write to both groups, or were you focusing more on writing to Jews, since you yourself are a Jew?
Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, you know, often authors know this. When you start to write a book, you don't always know exactly where it's going to go. I thought I was going to write something of a memoir to talk about my own experience sort of growing up as a Zionist, and then what happened to those convictions and those beliefs and even that basic identity when I was exposed to the modern state of Israel, the occupation of the West Bank, and the other narrative of the birth of the state of Israel, which is the Palestinian narrative, which is very different than the triumphal romantic narrative that the Jews have. They call it the Nakba, the catastrophe. And I was just going to write about that. But what happened to me was that, it turned out that at least half of the book is Christian theology. And here's why. When I came back in 2006 from this crisis that I had, a really transformative experience, when I visited Israel and the West Bank in 2006 for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and really got a good look at what was happening over there, which smashed my assumptions and my beliefs, I wanted to come back to my own community, the Jewish community, and tell them about it. The message would have been, look, the story we've been told is not the whole story. In fact, it's quite distorted, and what's happening over there is not good. It really threatens the Jewish community in Israel. Israel is on a suicide course, and besides that, we're doing wrong, and the Palestinians are not this sworn enemy of hateful terrorists who want to kill us. They're good people, and we have done them wrong. Well, the Jewish community here institutionally was not ready for that message, and those doors are pretty much closed to me. There's starting to be some chinks in that wall, but not much, and certainly back in 2006 there still wasn't much. But the churches were, the doors opened. Christians were very interested in hearing about this, because this is a social justice issue. And churches, I learned, those that I think deserve the name, are not simply involved in prayers on Sunday and on Christmas and on Easter, but are very involved in working for social justice and in basically following what Jesus says in Matthew 25 about what you're supposed to do.
But weren't you a little bit nervous about the Christian churches' response to your concerns about the Palestinians? Weren't you a little concerned it might be rooted in anti-Jewish feelings and actions that have such a horrid history in Christianity?
Well, anti-Semitism plays very, very big in this whole story, Stephen. You raise a good point. I mean,
I knew you knew the answer because I've read your book.
Right, you know the answer. Those who defend Israel and who want to, not to put too fine a point on it, who want to muzzle or suppress or to counter any talk that they feel would threaten particularly American support, diplomatic and financial support for the state of Israel, will claim that, yes, it's good to feel, you know, for your heart to bleed for the Palestinians, but don't go there because you simply will be giving support and ammunition to the anti-Semites, certainly in the Christian community. And to be anti-Israel, basically, is to be anti-Semitic. Don't go there. Israel is threatened, it's surrounded by enemies, and we have to support Israel because they are outnumbered. And also, as Christians, don't we feel a huge measure of responsibility for what we did to the Jews for 2,000 years? So how can we possibly even think of challenging the Jewish national homeland self-determination, self-defense project? That's not what I found to be true. the Christians who were eager to hear about the Palestinians were eager to hear about the Palestinians the same way that they would be eager, that they're eager to hear about people who are, you know, being disappeared in Argentina or who are made refugees in Sudan or who are being orphaned, you know, in Romania. This was a social justice issue. The problem was that they felt constrained from being able to take this on as they would any social justice issue, including, you know, domestic social justice issues, the urban missions right here in our backyard, because they felt that they didn't have the right to challenge the Jews because of the tragic, traumatic Christian-Jewish history. We can't go there. We can't touch this. It's off the table. We have spent 65 years since the end of World War II reconciling with the Jewish people, trying to be, you know, trying to make it okay again. We don't want to spoil that. We don't want to disrupt that. We have to leave it alone. And yet, they knew that there was something wrong about that. Nobody wants to be accused of being called an anti-Semite when they're not. And nobody wants to be made to feel guilty. And when I, as a Jew, stood before these Christian audiences and said, I am here to tell you that Israel is doing wrong, that if you want to be a friend to Israel, you should challenge Israel as you would any family or friend who is sinning, who is out of line, who is out of control. And that's the loving thing to do. And this message has been received, the only word I can use, this message has been received gratefully and with a kind of hunger to hear it. And that's basically what the book is about.
We're talking with Mark Braverman. The book he's talking about is one he has written called Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. Mark Braverman was raised in a conservative Jewish family, born in 1948 in Philadelphia. He has many family roots that go back many generations in Palestine, even before the founding of the State of Israel. This is a live call-in show, and let me give the phone numbers for people who'd like to ask a question. All I ask is that you keep your questions or comments relatively brief so we can get to other folks and so our guests can have a chance to talk. The number in Champaign-Urbana, if you're in the 217 area code, is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. And that's true if you're listening on the Internet anywhere in the continental U.S., you may use that toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, this program is heard, is live at will.illinois.edu/AM. And if you'd like to hear this program after it's archived, if you're unable to hear the whole 58 minutes live, you may go to it at your convenience at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith and leave the G out of keeping. We're informal about that, and you'll be able to listen to this and all in other previous programs. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Mark Braverman. Mark, you mentioned that half of the book is Christian theology, and since this program deals with religion and ethics and values and spirituality, as opposed to focus, which will deal with the political issues more, when you talk with David Inge at 10 o'clock Friday, February 10, when you're actually in this community rather than Washington, D.C. But since half the book deals with Christian theology, You've Walter Brueggemann, a famous Old Testament or Hebrew Scripture scholar, has written the foreword to your book. You quote Walter Wink. You even happen to quote Bob Osborne, my thesis advisor back at Duke years ago,
In
Jim Charlesworth's book. But anyway, you've read all these Christian theologians and biblical scholars. Why?
Well, I mean, this is part of the journey, and it's part of what's been so wonderful for me. You know, again, growing up Jewish, I keep going back to that, growing up Jewish, you weren't supposed to, Christianity was a bad word. Christianity and Jesus represented threat, murder, mayhem, suffering, marginalization, persecution. Christians were our enemies. And, you know, the New Testament was a book that, I wouldn't even open to look at. The Gospels were some sort of, dangerous or evil or anti-Jewish tract. And churches and Christians were dangerous. I had to avoid them. I had to stay inside my Jewish bubble. What happened to me, and I guess you could say it's ironic, is when I traveled to Palestine and Israel, and I traveled to the Holy Land in 2006 and crossed over that line from the Jewish section to the Palestinian section where I wasn't supposed to go because it was dangerous and these people hated us and all of that, I realized that I was feeling an enormous amount of identification and attraction to these people, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, the Palestinians. And I was leaving my bubble, and it wasn't just a sociological bubble. It was a spiritual and religious bubble as well. I think the sort of the critical event, and I write about this in my book, and I don't think I ever give a lecture where I don't talk about what happened to me that day. I was with this delegation. It was mostly Christians, a few Jews, and one or two Muslims if we could get them, through immigration in Tel Aviv. All Americans, all North Americans. We were in East Jerusalem, and we visited an organization called Sabil. Sabil is an Arabic word meaning the way, also sort of a spring of water. It is an organization of Palestinian Christians, Anglicans. And, many people in America assume that because Palestinians are Arabs, they are all Muslim. Well, Arab does not mean Muslim. Arab means Arab. And most Arabs happen to be Muslim for historical reasons. But there's been a Christian community in Palestine for, when you ask Palestinian Christians how long they've been there, or when, sometimes the question is, when did you convert to Christianity? The answer only half jokingly is about 2,000 years ago. And probably, this is a bit of a digression, if you want to talk about continuity in a sense of genetic connection to the Jews of the Second Temple and of Jesus' time, the current Palestinian Christians are probably more genetically linked to the Jews of that time and to the and to Jesus himself than I am as a Jew of European extraction. Anyway, we visited Sabil. Sabil was founded by an Anglican priest by the name of Naim Atik, who himself at the age of 8 in 1948 was dispossessed, was kicked out of his village in the Galilee by the Jewish forces. And he devoted his life, instead of to hatred, to working with his community, with his Christian community in Palestine, to help them survive, being dispossessed and being occupied. And they do a lot of education about nonviolence and to try to keep the Palestinian Christian community alive. And so they have an office in Jerusalem, and we visited them, and they talked about themselves and their community and their work. We were sitting in a circle getting a lecture talk from a woman named Nora Carmi, who herself is a dispossessed Jerusalemite. She was born in West Jerusalem in a neighborhood where my family now lives and the houses that Palestinians used to live in before 48. And she talked about her experience. Excuse me. She can't go back there. She has a strong sense that the world has forgotten the Palestinians, that they're on the side of the Jews, that the Palestinians are a forgotten, misunderstood people. Difficult to keep their children in the country because there's very little future for them there. And it's bad. And yet they're there and they have faith. And I asked her how that could be, how she could maintain her faith, and how she could maintain a sense of hope and continue to work and even stay in the country because she has options. In the face of this, in the face of the fact that it's getting worse, that Israel is taking more land, they're feeling more, they're being more and more squeezed. And I'll never forget what she said to me. She said, "We follow Jesus." Who was he? He was a Palestinian Jew who lived under Roman occupation. He was a member of an oppressed, occupied, indigenous community that was being taxed to death, that was basically a 99% that was being victimized by a 1%, which was the Roman Empire, and a client, a Jewish client government that was working for them in Jerusalem, running the temple. And he was trying to teach his people about how to have hope, how to not be violent, because he saw what the result was of the violent Jewish insurrections in his time. And that the way you preserve yourself and your identity and your families and your communities is to continue to remember what it means to follow God. What do the Mosaic laws say about social justice and inequality and taking care of the poor and the widow and the orphan, you know, the least of my brethren? She said, that's who Jesus was, and we follow him as Christians. She said, empires come and empires go. We follow Jesus. We're here. And I'll tell you, Steve, I was blown away. I wasn't quite sure what it was that was happening to me, but I knew that this was a really, really important thing for me to hear, because I had been feeling torn apart. You know, I wanted to be in East Jerusalem with the Palestinians and not in West Jerusalem with the Jews, my family, where I spoke Hebrew, where I knew the culture down to myself. I wanted to be with those others who were supposed to be my enemy, and I didn't know what it meant. You know, was I supposed to convert to Catholicism or to Christianity? Was I supposed to become an Arab or a Palestinian? And this was the answer. The answer was that what I was feeling was exactly what I had been taught as a Jew. Because Jesus was in the same line as the prophets, the Old Testament prophets. They spoke truth to power. They stood in front of the king and the priests and said, "Thou dost evil. You're not following God. You're not good with God. Remember what you're here to do. Remember what the Bible says." And what I was seeing was that in this case, it happened to be my own people who were doing wrong, and that the victims, the poor people, the least of my brethren, were these Palestinians, Christians and Muslims. And that what I was feeling, in fact, was very, very Jewish. And I identified with these Christians, and I identified with the teachings of Jesus. Now, it didn't mean I had to convert to Christianity. I mean, it had nothing to do with it. It meant that I was reclaiming what I feel is the core of my Jewishness, a core that I feel Zionism is really threatening. We are not supposed to be doing this. We are not supposed to be, if you want to talk about Walter Wink, we are not supposed to buy into the myth of redemptive violence. Violence does not redeem. Violence kills. It kills your own soul. It does more damage to you than it does to your enemy. And I was seeing that clearly. So that's why the theology is so important, because when I came back and started to speak to Christians, and especially to interact with clergy and with theologians, Christian, they pushed back at me and they said, no, you can't be doing this. Our theology requires that we put reconciliation with the Jewish people ahead of solidarity with the Palestinian people and with justice. I mean, they literally said that to me. They said, because of our history, we have to be penitent. We have to make this right. And so we have to support this Jewish nationalist project. I mean, Steve, that really is the main line theology and Christianity today since post-war.
Since the Holocaust, sure.
Yeah, since the Holocaust. It's all about post-Holocaust theology, and the Christians really are putting reconciliation with the Jewish people ahead of social justice in this case, in the case of Palestine. And I just, I just think it's wrong. I think that it is a betrayal of the core of Christianity. I mean, when Jesus stood in front of the temple, you know, in his entrance to Jerusalem in the last week of his life on earth, and said, "This is coming down, and I'll build it up in 3 days," and the apostles said to him, "What do you mean? It's impossible. We've been building this thing for 46 years." And then the narrator in the Gospel of John says, well, he's speaking of the temple of his body. The temple of Jerusalem, this temple of stone, which represents all that is wrong with empire, is going to be replaced by the body of Christ, which means all of humanity united in a universal communion, all equal, all loved equally by God. Jesus was taking Judaism where it was supposed to go, and he was responding to the crisis of the Roman Empire and what had happened to the Judaism of his time. I think that the parallels to our time today are very, very clear and very, very compelling. And somebody has to say it. And it's not being said in the academy and in the churches today.
We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon with our guest, Mark Braverman. His last name is spelled B-R-A-V-E-R-M-A-N. He's the author of Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. He'll be a guest at the University of Illinois here in about 12 days on Friday, February 10, and Saturday, February 11. He'll be speaking, as I count it, 7 different times, including on the air again with David Inge on WILL, talking about the political ramifications of and social ramifications that he is advocating in his book, Fatal Embrace. The phone numbers again, 333-9455. We'll put you on the air. If you give us a ring, our good technical director, Kyle Crow, will set you in line to talk to our guest today. Please keep your questions or comments relatively short so we can proceed. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. Let me take just a minute before we get back to Dr. Braverman to make a couple announcements. There's a Faith and Science in Dialogue coming up later this week, Tuesday, February 7, at 7 p.m. at the St. Andrews Lutheran Campus Center here at the University of Illinois. That's on South Wright and Chalmers, right across from Lincoln Hall, that's being repaired. Diana Noland, a professor and horticulture instructor at the university, will be speaking on faith and flowers. And she's a colleague here on WILL-TV, a Mid-American Gardener. And then later, March 13, Bruce Rhodes will be the speaker. Esmael Mezami will be the final speaker this spring semester, April 10th. All of this at St. Andrews Lutheran Campus Center. Faith and Science in Dialogue. Coming up to the University Y here in Champaign this Friday, February 3rd, will be the first Friday forum in the series Creative Approaches to Global Development. And Barry Pittendry, professor of insect toxicology, will be talking on scientific animations without borders, using mobile media to promote global development. Those are some of the lectures coming up on campus that listeners to Keeping the Faith might find of interest. And I remind you, you'll get to see Mark Braverman in person February 10, Friday, sponsored by the Urbana-Champaign Peace Initiative. There's a breakfast discussion at 8:30 Friday, February 10 at the University YMCA on Wright and Chalmers, right across from St. Andrews Lutheran Church. And the role of faith, communities, and achieving a just peace in the Holy Land. Then he'll be on the radio at 10 o'clock with David Inge here on Focus at Will 580 AM. At 11:30, there'll be a public lecture in the Foreign Language Building on campus, sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. That'll be at 11:30 in the Lucy Ellis Lounge. That's on the main quad up by the auditorium, Foreign Language Building. 1 o'clock, he has Speaking to a Class. 3 o'clock, student discussion at the United Church of Christ Campus Ministry on 6th Street. That's Community United Church of Christ. At 6 o'clock, another public lecture on Friday the 10th, The Path to Peace in Israel and Palestine, a Jewish American's Journey. That's at the Champaign Public Library on Green Street, of course. Saturday, February 11, a public discussion at 9:30 at the St. Matthew Lutheran Church on South Philo Road, Taking the Next Step, Our Role in Bringing Peace to the Holy Land. Well, we have several callers waiting, so Mark, let's just go to the phones. And
okay.
First of all, line number one. Yes, you're on the air.
I've got several points to make. First, I'd like to say that historically, a lot of what's been said is quite inaccurate. But let me take to task. First, this theological point about Christians and Jews. If you are aware, the Catholic Church and a lot of the mainline Protestant churches have great difficulty and have great difficulty with the existence of the State of Israel because it challenges their idea that they inherit the chosenness of Israel through Jesus. And this has been theologically discussed by theologians like Wishegard, who you might be familiar with or not.
I am familiar with him, yes.
So he actually challenges a lot of what you say, that it's both theologically questionable and historically questionable. I mean, the fact is that the Catholic and Protestant churches have had great problems recognizing the State of Israel even in 48 because they are unable to face the fact that if the Jewish people had a state of their own, then that questions the inheritance of Jewish chosenness by God theologically, which the Christians tried to claim to themselves. So that's the first major issue, which you seem to be mixing all up in your discussion. But the second point is, it seems like I hear in very strong strains of anti-Semitism in what you're saying about how you characterize the Jews and the Palestinians and the issues between them, the fact that both of them claim the same land and that there are issues. You seem to blame all the problems on the Jews, and the Palestinians seem to have no responsibility in what you say, and at least not what I've heard on the radio from you. And it's I'm amazed that you can go on with this, what to me seems anti-Semitic in many ways, undertones of it.
Okay, two important points. Let me take them in that order. I challenge the concept of inherited chosenness for Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, or anybody. And I think that it's a challenge for Christianity today to deal with this issue of what they call particularity, or actually the scandal of particularity.
Or supersessionism. Anyway, that's what...
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, or we can talk about supersessionism or displacement theology. Christianity quite appropriately had to take a look at that when they confronted the results of the anti-Jewishness of Christianity in the aftermath of World War II. I mean, they looked at that and they said, oh my God, what have we done? And Christians were quite right about that. The Nazi Holocaust was a direct result of anti-Semitism. It couldn't have happened without it. And so Christians really had to take a look at that and find out how to get rid of the anti-Judaism that had infected Christianity. And they have done a pretty good job of that.
The Catholic Church did not change anything until...
Not until Vatican II, I know. But let's not get into the weeds about the history of it. I think what's important here is the principle. The principle is that no religion, no religious group should claim for itself any superiority over any other people. And I believe that Christianity did fall into that, and it is now trying to correct that. But the way to do that is not to grant that chosenness and, you know, turn it upside down and say, oh, in fact, no, God loves the Jews best, and
that initial
covenant with Abraham is in place, and they get the land as a result. I think that that is not what God intends for Christians or Jews or anyone, and for Christians to turn around and grant that to the Jews sacramentally, I think is absolutely wrong.
But Christians never granted it to the Jews.
Oh, they're doing it now.
No, they're not. The Jews, those who settled in Israel, have their ethnic religious claim to it to the same extent as the Muslims or the Palestinians will have a claim, and that's for them to work out. It's not the Christians that gave it to the Jews. In fact, the Christians resisted it every which way they could, and they resisted it even after the existence of the State of Israel. So I think that's historically inaccurate what you're claiming.
Okay, well, so let's go on. Let's go on to your second point about what you're claiming is anti-Semitic in what I'm saying. First of all, we have to make a clear distinction between Zionism and Judaism and the State of Israel and the Jewish people. Now, the State of Israel has, as its avowed diplomatic mission, to make sure that no one makes that distinction, that if you say bad things about Israel or if you question Zionist ideology, then you are questioning Judaism. And as the point that I made at the opening of the program, Zionism is not Judaism. Jews, like anybody else, have the right to be non-Zionist or anti-Zionist, to believe that it is a tragically flawed ideology, as I do. I understand where it comes from. I understand why it seemed like a good idea in Tsarist Russia at the end of the 19th century, but I don't believe it's a good idea now. And I can say that, and that does not make me an anti-Semite. I'm one of the more pro-Israel people that I know, because I would like to see the Jewish community in Israel today survive and have a future. And it has no future with the current political course that it is.
If you demonize the State of Israel...
I am not demonizing the State of Israel.
And you use double standards, and you challenge the basic legitimacy of the state, not the policies, but the legitimacy of the state of the Jewish people, then that's anti-Semitic.
All right, let me make some very clear distinctions here, okay? I do challenge the legitimacy of the current policies of the State of Israel. I do that absolutely and categorically with respect to the Palestinians and what they're doing in the West Bank and what they have been doing since 1948.
So
I do not
now. To the State of Israel.
And if you say I'm saying that the State of Israel has no right to exist, states don't have rights. States have responsibilities. States have to behave themselves. And if you have Israel behaving the way it is, which is similar to the way South Africa was behaving under apartheid, and which is similar to the way our own government was behaving when Jim Crow ruled in the United States, that has to be fixed. It's not a question of challenging the state itself. Israel can continue to exist, but it can't continue to do what it's doing. As far as the question of only blaming Israel and not blaming the Palestinians for the conflict, look, I don't idealize the Palestinians any more than I demonize the Israelis. But the Palestinians have no power, they are weak, they are stateless, and they are guilty of acts of violent popular resistance, which I don't agree with, but I understand. Israel is the big kid on the block. Israel has all the power. Israel is responsible for the dispossession of the Palestinian people and for the conflict that ensues, because if you have an indigenous population that's being stepped on, you're going to have conflict. And it's not going to end until the Palestinians are treated fairly. That does not make me anti-Semitic. If I turn around and I say that about my own country, it doesn't make me anti-American. When the whole world turned against South Africa and employed economic sanctions, which forced the Pretoria government to go into negotiations and to change its structure, they did not do it because they were anti-South African and they hated the South Africans. They did it because they could not accept the behavior of that government, and so it had to change. That's where Israel is today, and that's our responsibility.
Israel is not an apartheid state. That is exactly where your assumptions are not true. Let's start with the fact that...
I'm afraid I'm going to have to interrupt. We have other callers waiting, yes. And I do appreciate the points raised by this caller, but we do need to move on and give somebody else some airtime. Let me go to line number two, and we'll see what comments are raised here. Line number two, yes, go ahead. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Mark Braverman.
Thank you. I was born a Jew, and I will die a Jew. But that doesn't make me feel comfortable the way Israel is behaving as a state. And should a particular group want to call itself, for spiritual reason, the chosen people, that's their business, but they cannot abuse their neighbors. And in this case, their neighbors are our brethren. I mean, you know, if you look back at the people who came from the same location that the Jews did, is we were all brethren. So it's a double sin, as far as I'm concerned, for us to treat our neighbors so badly. So I wish to, in these arguments, separate religion from nationality. I think the two have nothing to do with each other. I think this is a political problem. Any group is perfectly welcome to handle their spiritual life as they see fit. And that has nothing to do with oppressing your neighbor. I think the two have to be split. There's a lot of sin on the part of the Palestinians. There is a lot of sin on the part of the Jews in Israel. If you want to call it the Jewish government, you know, that's fine. I belong to a group called Peace Now, and we are a group of Americans and Israelis who wish to have a political peace. We are not trying to tell any group how they should behave spiritually, you know, and if a group wants to call itself the chosen people, who am I to say differently? And it's not a question of spirituality. It is a question of politics and humanity. And, you know, I can understand the vehemence of the previous caller. He's obviously very devoted to the state of Israel. And the people who belong to Peace Now are also devoted to the state of Israel. But we don't think the state of Israel can survive should it treat its neighbors as inhumanely as it has been doing. So that's my take on the situation, and I will leave the phone line for the next commentator.
Thank you very much for your call. Any response to that, Dr. Braverman?
I really don't have anything to add to that. Let's go to another question.
All right. Let me just take a moment to let listeners know what's coming up in the next few programs here on Keeping the Faith. Every Sunday night from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time here on WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3, as well as simulcast at will.illinois.edu/AM. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and I get the fun of interviewing some fascinating people locally as well as around the world. Coming up next week, Professor William Berkson, who has written a recent commentary on an ancient second century Jewish text. We'll talk on the Jewish sages on psychology. That'll be February 5th here on Keeping the Faith. On February 12th, we have a Christian biblical scholar, Professor J. Wilcoxon from Chicago. He'll be talking about current study Bibles. These are mainly Christian study Bibles, although one of the ones we'll be talking about is a recent Jewish study Bible. That's February 12. On February 19, we'll be interviewing by phone Jay Mickelson about the religious case for gay rights. Jay Mickelson will be a speaker at the local Hillel Foundation here at the University of Illinois later on. On February 26, Christopher Mitchell will be our guest again by phone from near Chicago in Wheaton from the Wade Center. He'll be talking about a collection of materials on the Christian writer C.S. Lewis that are there available for scholars and other people interested in the writings of C.S. Lewis. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. Okay, back to our guest, Mark Braverman. Mark, when you went to with the Fellowship of Reconciliation to visit Palestine in 2006, that was not at all your first visit to Israel and Palestine. Tell us about some of your experiences earlier and why you were there.
I first visited, as a boy of 17 with a synagogue group. It was really my first meeting and sort of a kind of a reunion with the family that my grandfather had left behind. And looking back on it, I realized it was a bit like the return of the prodigal son. You know, he was not actually loved for having left. You weren't supposed to. And so here comes his grandson, who is a very devoted Jew, who can pray in the synagogue, who speaks fluent Hebrew. In a way, I think I sort of redeemed him for his defection from the Holy Land. And it was wonderful for me. I mean, I loved my family, and I was in love with Israel. It was a romantic dream that I had been raised on, and what I saw fulfilled that dream. I didn't see the other side. I saw the wonderful, and it is a wonderful culture that was built, the kibbutzim and the agriculture and the Jewish culture that had taken root. It was wonderful, and my family was very much part of that. But I remember one scene sticks in my mind, and when I ask myself now, in middle age, what was it? What were the seeds that may have been planted that led me to return in 2006 in this very different way? I remember this one scene. I'm 17 years old, and I'm sitting with my aunt and my cousins in their religious agricultural village near the Mediterranean, and it's a Sabbath, and we're talking. And suddenly the conversation shifts to talking about the Arabs, quote, the Arabs. And I remember listening to them, and with a kind of shock and confusion, realizing that I didn't know who these Arabs were, but the way my family was talking about them was the way white people talked about black people in the Philadelphia where I grew up, which, of course, is pre-civil rights. So I knew racism when I heard it because I had been schooled in that. My father was very, very active in the ADL when they were the good guys and they were working for racial equality here in the United States and hadn't turned into...
And ADL is?
ADL is the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith,
right,
which has become a watchdog agency to make and basically is in bed with the neocons, but that's another story. But my father was very, very politically progressive, almost pink, really. And so I knew racism when I heard it. I was very attuned to it, and I realized that these people whom I love, that's my family, were racist with respect to these Arabs. And of course, I put that away. I mean, it didn't fit with the program.
That was 1965.
This was 1965.
Yeah.
Then after college, I went back to Israel and to live on a kibbutz. And at that point, I was sort of in a rebellion against the religious Judaism that I've been raised in. I wasn't going to synagogue anymore. I was out there eating cheeseburgers and milkshakes, and I just, you know, I was not with that program anymore. It was kind of an adolescent stage for me. But I also really still identified very strongly as a Jew, and I really wanted to go back to Israel because I loved it. And I went to live on a kibbutz, and most of the kibbutzim were founded by left-wing, you know, by communists from Europe.
Early socialists.
They were anti-religious. They were non-religious, totally secular. So it was a way to be a Jew and be in Israel and not have to be religious. And it's kind of the point of the early Zionists, so I was into that. I lived on a kibbutz. I lived on a kibbutz in the Galilee, right on the northern border south of Lebanon. This was an area that I now have learned was an arena of major, major ethnic cleansing in 1948. Those areas had to be gotten rid of, had to be cleansed of as many Arabs as possible while the opportunity existed during hostilities between 47 and 49. This is the Nakba. This is the other narrative. So I went to live in its kibbutz, not knowing that it itself was a cleansed village that was the scene of an atrocity where about two dozen civilians, children and women, were murdered by Zionist forces in 48, and the rest escaped, and their descendants are now living up in Lebanon in squalid refugee camps. I didn't know that story. I was living in this beautiful kibbutz that was founded by a cell of labor Zionists from Chicago in 1952. They were given this land. But I remember finding myself in a nearby Palestinian village, which was full of IDPs. These were people who did not leave and go to Lebanon, but stayed nearby, were never allowed to go back to their villages. And they were telling me about what happened to them. They lived in a village next door to my kibbutz, which is now a kibbutz. No, it's no longer a Palestinian.
And what year was this?
This is 1971. It was a wonderful year. I had a wonderful time on that kibbutz. But I'm sitting in this, in an Arab home. I'm sitting, drinking Arabic coffee, you know, enjoying Arab hospitality, and they're telling me about what happened with their village. They said, well, it's 1948, and the Zionist soldiers came, the Haganah came, and they said, you need to leave just for a little while. You can come back, but for security purposes, we need to clear you out. This is a dangerous place. I mean, you know, the defense forces are using the same line on Palestinians now in the West Bank. But anyway, so they left. And then guess what? They're not allowed to come back. Their village is...
Mark, we're down to our last minute.
Oh, they're locked up. Anyway, they said, we kept coming back, and then finally, Golda dynamited our village. And I remember that moment, because Golda, it was like saying that Abraham Lincoln was a war criminal. This is Golda Meir. So that was another seed in my mind, that there was another story here, something I had to find out about if I was to truly know who I was and really come together as a whole person.
I'm sorry to cut this short, and I'm sorry we can't have other people join the conversation, but there'll be another opportunity, both on this program, on this radio station on February 10, Friday, when Mark Braverman, the author of Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, will be in Champaign-Urbana. He'll be on David Inge's Focus program at 10 a.m. that morning. That's live. People can call in and ask him questions on that day as well. I've given the lineup twice of where he's speaking, but the public lectures, the large ones, will be 7 p.m. at the Champaign Public Library on Friday, February 10, The Path to Peace in Israel, Palestine, and a Jewish American's Journey. Saturday morning at 9:30 at St. Matthew Lutheran Church on Philo Road in Urbana. We're Twin Cities here, Mark, so you won't have to go too far to get to all the various places you're speaking when you're here those 2 days.
I'll definitely need some R&R after all of this. I want to thank you
for coming to this community as a guest of some of the departments of the university, as well as the Urbana-Champaign Peace Initiative. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, let me just remind folks, Professor William Bergson will be talking with us about his commentary on Pirkei Avot, the Jewish Sages on Psychology, will be his discussion for his time here on Keeping the Faith on February 5th. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Should Black History Month be ended? Find out why. More than a month, our next community cinema examines what the treatment of history tells us about race and power in contemporary America. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, February 7th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
This is Illinois Public Media, W.